It's kind of funny. Dave asked some marketing things up here up front so that these folks could have more information. You told me, you know what he told me? He says, I don't want you to talk about marketing with them. Don't ask them about marketing. Are you guys ready to do that? We're not going to talk about marketing. We are going to talk about a little bit about marketing, but he told me not to do that. So up in front, we have some folks that you're familiar with. Did anybody listen to Commodity Week? Who heard Commodity Week? Is everybody really sad after Commodity Week? Yeah. Wow. Commodity Week was something else. Yeah, that was a rough Commodity Week. On hand with us today is the person who made it pretty rough on Commodity Week. He is only the bearer of the bad news, not his opinions. Well, he's only the bearer of the bearish news. How about that? Is that right? Glenn Ring is with us. Glenn is with Glenn Ring Enterprises. He's out of Cedar Falls in Iowa. Next to him is John Bondurant. Everybody loves to hear John Bondurant. I think that's one of the ones that I look forward to in April. I get calls ahead of that. When's John Bondurant going to be on Commodity Week? Because John's a big farmer. He's in Memphis. And on Commodity Week, he always has everything planted. It's about April 6th, April 8th. And he tells us that he made a decision 3 weeks before he planted, usually, of what his acreage mix was actually going to be looking like. So a couple of years ago, he said, it all went to corn. And he just made that decision. He just made that decision. So you heard me, I think, talk about this. You guys are all in that. Is everybody in that place this year? Don't have tillage done? Don't have your fertilizer on? You all get to be John Bondurant. You wanted to do that, didn't you? Didn't you want to do that? You wanted to have that decision? How's it feel, by the way? Yeah, not so good. So John Bondurant is with Bondurant Futures. He's a guest occasionally on Commodity Week, usually in April and October, and we look forward to hearing from him today. He's actually on two panels. He'll be back to talk about his farming operation, but he's going to talk about the brokerage side in just a bit. Next to him is Sue Martin of Webster City, Iowa. Everybody knows Sue. Sue is on every day at 12:55 or thereabouts at the radio station. One of the few people on the radio station that Dave and I don't have to ask questions of. It's kind of different for WILL, but Sue comes on and she talks about all kinds of things at for about 2 minutes. Well, actually, she's supposed to be about a minute, but usually it's about three. But it's close. It's close. And Sue is there every day. She's from Webster City, Iowa, and we do appreciate you flying in today. Actually, we have a lot of folks from Iowa here today. Chip Flory is with us as well. Everybody been to the AgWeb website? No, Chip Flory from Pro Farmer. Chip always comes on. They do the crop tours in August, and he operates the crop tours, and they take those legs out. And we do a lot of talking to Chip in August about the size of the crop. Chip, thank you so much for being here today. And next to Chip is Mr. Freed. Steve Freed from ADM. And we're going to start with Steve because, Steve's with ADM, and lots of the brokers get a lot of information from him. You folks hear a lot of information from Steve. But what we really don't know, Steve, is what you do for a living all the time. So this is where I want to start with you, and we're going to go across the panel and talk to you just about what you do for a living and how you go about doing it. So let's start with Steve Freed. What's your job day in and day out?
First of all, a little, this is a joke, okay? But Joe, I'd like to thank you for giving me tomorrow's numbers already.
Yeah.
That's what I do.
I
also would like to thank the United States Department of Agriculture for taking some heat this year off of the Chicago Board of Trade and also the grain companies. I've been giving speeches to farmers for the last 2 months from Nebraska to Ohio, from North Dakota through Illinois and Indiana. And everybody blames the USDA, so I kind of got off the hook and got out of the situation. But it's my job at ADM Investor Services to write 3 comments a day on the grain markets. I get my information from all over the world, and been doing this. I started out with Continental Grain Company as a crop scout, looking at maybe some of the fields that you guys grow, kind of secretively driving through the areas, and I've been 17 years with ADM Investor Services. I also want to take a little bit of a chance here to remind all you guys to support the farm radio system. It's an unbiased, it's a professional wealth of information that helps you make your farm planning and your marketing, and I know that everybody in the industry is struggling, and so your support is needed to keep this information flow. But sometimes I think my job is that I'm an overpaid weatherman, so that's where I'll leave it. So.
Okay. Next to Steve is Chip Flory. Chip, what do you do day in and day out?
Okay, well, the most important thing that I do every week is put together Pro Farmer Newsletter. We've got about 14,000 members across the country that we provide news and information for. That's the number one priority that we have. Analysis and risk management follows that. But that is absolutely the most important thing that we do every week is we put that newsletter together and we get it out the door Friday afternoon. You can get it on email, and if you're still getting it snail mail, some of you don't get it until Wednesday. But little known connection here up here on the panel, Todd. Glenn and I work together. I'm in my 22nd or 23rd year. But when Pro Farmer was owned by Oster Communications, Glenn and I worked together there. John and I worked together on a product called GlobalLink that was owned by Oster Communications. Sue and I rode in a single prop, chartered plane from Iowa to Fargo on the coldest day of the year.
I told him I'd never let him do it again.
And Steve and I took a fishing seminar together years ago. Yeah, so there's a connection up here with everybody on the panel. So, but the most important thing, Todd, is the newsletter every week.
Yeah, no insider trading there. Don't worry about it at all. John Bondurant, tell me about the brokerage business.
You forgot Sue.
Oh, I did forget Sue. Sue.
Saving best for last.
No, well, Sue, I'm sorry.
Basically, we start every day looking at the markets, looking over research of news and what's going to drive the market that day. Our primary focus is to help producers make sales and make them timely. And by doing so, we put a lot of focus on timing of the markets and patterning as to where the highs and lows should come, barring no weather interferes.
Now, John.
What I do with my day, I'm primarily a fund manager in commodities. I'm a full-time speculator. And secondarily, I'm a fairly decent-sized farmer. So I spend most of my day reading. Read everything I can put my hands on about China, about Europe, currencies, economy, debt, everything. I speculate in everything that moves. Right now, I've got a position in the Japanese bond market, which is kind of exotic. But my favorite commodities to trade are beans and cotton. But most of my day is spent trying to think of good trades.
Glenn Ring?
Todd, my wife has asked me the same question for 30 years, so and I have yet to figure out a good answer. I am a student of market behavior. I study markets. I study market history. I write a daily market report. I write a biweekly and weekly newsletter. I teach. I provide information. Mostly, though, each morning I take out my quarter and flip it. Now, I don't really care much about day-to-day activity, and I look at long-term trends, and I just try to be a steward of the gifts I've been given. That's what I really try to do, and that's one of the reasons we've been pushing so hard this winter with meetings out on the road.
Okay. So I said, he asked me not to talk about markets, but we're going to just a bit anyway. I need a show of hands up here. Which of you among you are bearish, more bearish, the bean market? And Glenn, are you going to give me a hand, or are you going
to? Todd, doesn't matter. I am not bearish or bullish. I just report what I see.
That's the reason I asked. I thought that would be the case. Okay, so we've got four of the five that would report saying they're bearish, the bean market. How about the corn market? Bearish or neutral or bullish? So that's bearish, neutral. We got one neutral. Sue's neutral. And John is neutral and bullish.
And you're talking old and new?
Yep.
General?
Generally.
Next hour.
Right? So we've got two that are feeling pretty friendly in the marketplace. We'll come back to that later, but that's where we are. Let's talk about some of the things that happen in your daily lives. Sue Martin, we know more about your daily life and the marketplace than most because these folks hear you and so do we. What's a moon cycle and how does it work?
A moon cycle?
Yep. What's a moon cycle and how does it work in your grain marketing decisions?
Well, actually, all I know is a full moon and a new moon seem to make craziness in the market. They add volatility, but that's all I use it for.
Okay, good enough. Let's talk about China just a bit. Who's been to China? Okay, Steve Fried's been to China. Steve, I had somebody ask about China out here, and you and I had discussed this earlier that we wanted to talk about China. They wanted to know where all the acres in China were grown and what that meant on the global economy.
Well, China's a fascinating country. I've only been there once. I gave a speech there, so I didn't get to meet all 1.2 billion people. Most of the corn and soybeans is grown in the northern regions. Your wheat is grown all across the western regions. I think the thing that I learned in China, number one, is they're going to continue to consume commodities. They have to balance overheated economy versus, where you're going to get new jobs for all the various people. You come back, there was definitely a feeling that they believe that there will be a decline in supply of crude oil and that they're very bullish energy prices long term. You get a definite feeling that they're concerned about their ability to grow crops to satisfy their demand because of water. They continue to see a decline in water, and about 70% of the land in China is irrigated. You definitely believe that they want to be self-sufficient, that they know the impact of their buying would have on world commodity prices, but it's going to be unavoidable, I think, if they reach the goal of doubling their hog herds from their current numbers to satisfy their domestic protein need. If you look at the change year to year of GDP growth, economic growth in the world since 1970. Right up to the year 2000, countries like the United States, Europe, Canada were the leading growth economic indicators. The last 3 years, it's been China. And so you see a dramatic change in the impact China's growth has on all of financial markets. The other thing I think you notice is that the guesstimate is that we have about 430 million middle-class people in the world right now. By 2030, there'll be a billion people in the middle class, and most of the increase will be in China. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing kind of an economic shift from the United States being maybe the economic leader to down the road China being the economic leader. So I think everybody in the room needs to go there, get a chance to visit their people. They all want to work. They all want to own a home. They all want to have a family. They all want to have a better life. And those things could be really positive, especially for agriculture.
Chip, you're shaking your head in agreement about China, in particular about the hog herd.
Yeah.
Suggested and this is, by the way, the largest hog herd on the planet. Something more than, the last time I heard, more than 400 million, and it may be bigger than that at this point.
Yeah, what, three times the size of the U.S. hog herd?
Something like that. It's an enormous hog herd. To begin with, it was not in confinement systems and not along the coast because it was all one or two pigs in the back of the house. But China's changing dramatically, and that's had probably as big an impact, I suppose, and you can tell me, Chip, whether this is the case or not, on soybean exports to China.
Absolutely. Steve was talking about the about China wanting to be self-sufficient on agriculture. I think we're seeing the country reevaluate that stance. They want to be self-sufficient on corn production because if they did import corn or relied on the world market for corn, the world market could only supply maybe 20% of their domestic needs. something like that. But when you talk about soybeans, if they commit more and more of their acres to corn production and rely more and more on imports from the U.S. and South America on soybeans, then all of a sudden they can start to balance things out and grow that hog herd. One company to watch to see how that China market is doing is Ag Feed Inc. It trades under FEED, and it's a pretty good indicator of just how that Chinese hog industry is doing. And right now, it's not doing very well. A lot of disease issues and so on that we've got to see a bounce back from eventually.
So, Martin, when you look at this whole prospect, and maybe you can talk a bit about the markets itself and the day-to-day trade, what does it do in the marketplace when China makes decisions? How does the market react, generally speaking? How is this? How is all of the exports push the bean prices, and can it continue to happen?
Well, we have noticed, of course, that China's over 97-98% of what they were targeted to buy already purchased. So probably the most aggressive bought ahead sales to any one entity in history, maybe. The one thing I think that is a general attitude amongst traders is that they look for Chinese buy orders from U.S. soybeans to be canceled and switched over to South American crops. I think there's been a little surprise that that hasn't happened yet, and a little more surprise that they haven't been more aggressive on the South American crop itself. I think that when you hear this buying and the tremendous buying that we got, I think it supported the bean market quite high as we went through into December and kind of held us together into January. But the market is the futures is the future, and the traders were looking ahead, and they started to feel like the South American crop was going to come before too long, and they were trying to price it into the market. And I think we got that priced in by the early part of February. Now it will be how does that crop come out of South America, and I think that the one thing that we're noticing is that in Mato Grosso, probably there may be, I want to say, close to half harvested. What we're hearing is the yield isn't as good as what they thought, but still, just yesterday I got word from Ag Rural that they're estimating the bean crop down there to be 67.26 million metric ton crop. Huge. But it's getting it from the farm to the port. And a year ago, it took 50 bags per hectare, and out of 50 bags per hectare, you might have been using 13 bags per hectare to pay for the freight. This year, it's taking 23 bags per hectare to pay for the freight. And just this week, we noticed that Japan came into the market and bought U.S. corn because of the freight cost. Normally, we're $10 a metric ton higher on corn out of South America. And this year, they're running $17 to $10, $20 over us. So it's bringing some business back. Input costs are up for the South American farmer. It's negotiable as to how much money he's going to make on that crop at this time. He's a slow seller. It's estimated that only 34% of that crop is sold ahead. And there's a possibility that we could see with this crop coming to market as slow as it is, it may extend the marketing window for South America. In other words, what it could do is help us hold on in the world export market into April, May, and then turn around and see South American beans coming in our face when we're harvesting this coming fall. And that would be very bearish come fall.
Hey, Steve, can you confirm something for me? She suggested that the South American farmer was a slow seller. Does ADM see that? Do you see that in the way they market?
I think that to this point, most commercials down there in Brazil are surprised that whether it's Brazil or Paraguay that the farmer is not selling as much. Now, he has a bigger crop to sell, so the amount of tonnage that is coming to the market is about the same as it was a year ago. I think the interesting thing about Brazil is that they've done a really good job of increasing port capacity. They've done a really good, better job of logistics. I mean, we have 10 to 12 day waitings for vessels now, and a month ago everybody thought it'd be 40 days. And so I think that that's one thing that has been a surprise so far. But I think another point that was made earlier about China and how much they haven't bought as far as the May, June, July timeframe. I mean, the Chinese are bearish. I mean, they believe the prices are going to go down, so they haven't priced anything because of that.
John, is that right? Are the Chinese bearish, or are you bearish along with them?
Yes. I'm bearish because basically in the last decade, the largest supply-demand usage we've had is around 24.5%. And during this last decade, the low on beans have been from $4 to $6. The supply and demand usage balance sheet right now is around 25.5%. So really and truly, I've always been a speculator that says if the carryovers are going up or you are short, and if they're going down, you're long. But the carryover historically is extremely high, and I don't think it justifies anywhere close to $9 beans or $10 beans. China has bought incredible amounts of beans in the last year, more so than we've ever seen. And a lot of it supposedly is to protect their farmers and build a reserve, keep the price up, the farmers, keep the farmers happy and keep them on the farm and not rioting, et cetera. At a point in time, you reach where you just simply have too much grains. For instance, what we saw in wheat and rice in the last 2 years, you had sovereign countries, India, Thailand, Vietnam, get panicked on wheat and rice, buy it up themselves, hold on to it, and then sell it for half the price a year and a half later. And we are seeing that right today in rice and wheat. And I wonder if that's not going to happen in soybeans with China. And one other kick I have is the bullish side of all grains has been India and China, an emerging middle class that demands more protein as you go up the food chain. You eat pork and beef instead of vegetables and rice. But on the other hand, there's 79 countries in the world that are in negative population growth, and that includes China. And as we age, we eat less food. And I see China, Japan, all of North America, all of Europe, all of Russia in negative population growth. And we're sitting here projecting big growth numbers, and I wonder where they're going to come from. So.
Yeah, Sue, and then we're going to follow up with Glenn because I know he's got something to say on this issue.
Okay. One thing I want to bring to the attention is that, and this is a concern I have for the grain markets and the soy market. I tend to be on the fence, but probably lean a little more negative. And it's the fact that we're seeing China start to gravitate towards building reserves. And it used to be that they carried reserves of 108% of annual usage. And that was before they went into WTO. We're seeing Russia building reserves, India gravitating towards building reserves. You have huge crops coming out of South America, and it looks like they could be getting back on track to where they're going to be producing. And that's the area that can grow. And then you have the U.S. with the largest amount of bin storage that you've ever had in history, and the farmer very lackluster in selling that grain. And I fear, because on the long-term charts, when you get these funds going, get them bearish enough and they start getting into the marketplace and putting their positions down, the market always looks on the technical side for areas to gravitate to. And this isn't going to sound pretty, but I think it can happen. On the daily electronic charts, there are huge gaps that a lot of traders don't realize are there. On corn, it's from $2.33 to $1.95 on December corn. On soybeans, $7.20 to $6.54. I think wheat's got it from somewhere around $3.20 to $2.96, and soy meal down to $1.87. if that market gets bearish enough, it could go for those levels. You would maybe not stay there long, but you could go for it.
That's on the electronic trade only, though. That's not including the day trade or the open outcry trade.
That's not including the day trade. That's E-Trade. But I think if it's on E-Trade, it would also be on the day trade as well. But the key is it's on the electronic. And a lot of times the electronic doesn't show gaps where the day session will. I think that's kind of important.
Okay, Glenn. So we've had kind of a big, broad overview of China. It's not real pretty at this point. Can you... I know you can't make it any prettier, but why don't you talk to me about it anyway?
The first thing that strikes me is there's still a gap left at 23 cents in corn from 1933 that's uncovered.
All right. That's a bad gap.
And what worries me is we might cover it by 2016. And that's not a joke. Several things have struck me about what I've heard already. For one thing, John is dead on right. Population trends highly correlate with long-term inflationary trends throughout the history of man. As far back as I can track it, and I go back a long way. That's first and foremost. Second, I do a piece called The Cycle of Man, and there's three primary phases in that. It's called the survival phase, security phase, and the power phase, which we've just come through, which is highly speculative. Anyway, when you go into the survival and security modes, a lot of stockpiling goes on. And in those modes, economic activity slows markedly, dramatically, long-term trends. And ultimately, I guess it's a little off the track, but it feeds right into us. We are reaping the crop of 50 years of debt expansion at the private level. The problem in this country is we the people and the borrowing that we've done. In the history of man, credit can expand for about 50 years. If we were to follow the biblical side at 49 years, we'd be taken care of the next year with Jubilee. The market, we are going through Jubilee, basically, by natural means, I guess. And that means that we are our economic activity is going to contract for a long time. We should see people saving more. We will see people paying down debts. And we are reversing the leveraging that we did for 50 years. And that history says it'll take 50 to 150 years to unwind that leveraging. The worst of the price moves, though, are often seen in the first two, three decades. So I think our greatest risk is ahead of us. When I was asked earlier whether I'm bullish or bearish of grains, I'm not bullish or bearish. I report what I see. My probabilities are about 90% that we have major down years this year. I concur with Sue's numbers in corn. I think my difference on the beans with everything I've heard today is I am troubled by everybody's bearish. I just don't think they're bearish enough. I would ask, I'm looking at 498 to 508 as a likely target this year. And if it's not hit this year, it'll be hit in 2016 in all probability. But if it's hit this year, I'm worried about what 2016 will be. One question I have of the audience.
Go for it.
How many of you said believe acres of beans are up? Or I don't know. How many of you believe beans are bearish for 2000 and for the 10? All right. Keep them up. Now, how many of you have forward sold your beans for 2010? See, there's something illogical about people being bearish and not being sold. And when I listened to Joe do the NAS story, and the thing that struck me about it was the emails and stuff he got, is exactly right is to say, own what you can do, what responses you can make. You control how you respond. If the report took, how many dollars away, 16% of somebody's income away from them, they could have hedged that by selling before the report. So...
All right, questions out here. Who's got one? Oh, somebody's got a question for these guys out here before we get to corn. Yes, sir. Cotton. He just wants to know about cotton. John, you want to talk about cotton? We can do that.
I trade a lot of it. I can tell you that. The cotton's had a tremendous run. It all depends on the size of U.S. exports and the size of coming acreage around the world. Cotton prices have come up a whole lot while grain prices have been sliding, so I think we're going to see more cotton acreage worldwide. But personally, I don't think we're going to have a world crop this coming year that will be as big as world demand, so I'm friendly. Right now, I'm cautious because we've had a big run. We'll be planting corn. Corn's being planted today in the South Delta. I should be planting in mid-Delta, and it's been too wet. Beans will start late March, early April. Once the corn, beans, and rice are in the ground, that's it for cotton. It's what's left. So I'm ambivalent about cotton. I'm very, very much worried about a double-dip recession, and cotton is extremely sensitive to economic activity. It is the first in a recession and the first out. If you are a real commodity student, cocoa and cotton reflect recessions and booms very well. They seem to be leading indicators both ways.
Okay. Let's continue down this road just a bit. So we know that you mentioned a double-dip recession. So we know that in the Great Depression, the break came in 29, but the bottom came in 33, correct? Right?
Economic bottom came in 39. The price bottom came in 32, 33. Depends on what market you're looking at, yes.
All right. So, John, you're worried about a double-dip recession. What precipitates that? How does it take place?
I'm like Glenn. I'm scared to death of the debt. We have got so much debt everywhere that I'm afraid we're going to have, when the stimulus is around the world, run down. We've reached a point now where governments have such big deficits and such big stimulus, even if things go bad, they can't go any further because a lot of citizens around the world don't want any more debt. On the other hand, I worry about hyperinflation because I think paper currency is going to be really, really bad. And gold has been going up. I was a big bear on soybean prices in 11, and I quit selling 2011 beans. I've only sold 25% of them because I'm worried about it might have hyperinflation, but we may have a big deflationary bust prior. I think it's the hardest market setup I've ever seen.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
No doubt about it. I was out of the office a couple of weeks ago, called back, talked to Brian Grady, our senior analyst, asked him what's going on in the grain and cotton markets, and the first thing he mentioned was the Greeks offered debt. And I thought to myself, my God, I never thought this was going to happen, that a corn conversation would start with Greeks debt. To John's point about it's not only the U.S. that's got the debt problem, it's a global debt issue. And the conversation that we had just last week was what happens when Germany puts its foot down and says, no, we're not going to help Greece. You know, we're not going to do that. And then the fallout and the impact on the euro and the entire eurozone and the European Union, and do you see this thing start to crumble and break apart on us? That, I think, is what might be one of those risks out there when we start talking about the potential for a double dip.
Am I right in thinking, you asked how many people had already marketed, but am I right in thinking that in this situation you want to have as much sold up front as possible?
Yes.
And do you want to protect that then in some way?
Yes.
I get a bunch of people shaking their heads. Sue, go for it.
The one thing about I'm just looking at this year's crop, you know, the old crop that anybody's holding. Ours was all sold last year by June 18th. But in the meantime, I'm looking ahead at catch-up sales and the new crop for 2010-11. I've had people say, if you're that negative or think that the possibility of those prices exist, why are you not suggesting sales for 2011-12? And the reason is just what John just said. if we go into a hyperinflation, these grain prices could be too cheap. You could have your cash locked in too cheaply, and in the meantime, your inputs just go through the roof. That's the other concern I have, and I think it makes marketing extremely tough for farmers to do a the year-out type thing. And so at the moment, I guess I tend to just look at this year's new crop and what old crop is on hand, and I'm not worrying about 2011-12. But there is one thing that, and maybe Steve can add some to this too, that nobody's really talked about. And it was in Chile when they had that earthquake. The anchovy fish, a lot of, you know, in Capacion, their fish refineries and their fishing boats and the ports there, near there, that handle a lot of the fish meal and the product, the fish oil and the fish meal, not to mention the disruption in the waters, the kelp that the fish feed on. Now, you know, fish meal maybe accounts for maybe 9% of the world's usage, and fish oil maybe accounts for 10% in the world. But I wonder if there isn't going to be something that comes out of that, because that should be really disrupted. And I suspect, you know, that could still come back to play a hand on soy meal market. And also, if you look at China, that means more aquaculture that's going to have to be done to make up for it. And therefore, that's a lot of protein that China needs, either wheat or soy meal.
Questions out here. Where was my question?
A couple of weeks ago, there were some corn sold for unknown destinations. Who is that?
We hope China.
Other questions? Yes, sir.
John talked about cotton going up. John was talking about cotton going up. Will that increase cotton acres and take some of the strain off the extra acres for corn and beans?
I'd say about a million. There'll be about a million more cotton acres.
It's going to have some effect. Corn acreage in the Delta is going way down. I planted 2,500 acres last year, and I'm planting zero this year. I'm still not planting any cotton, because if you put a score sheet of soybean, rice is the most profitable, soybeans next, corn next, wheat corn after that, and cotton's on the bottom. I wonder if we're going to get all this cotton acreage, because it's still, I don't want to plant cotton. I own a cotton warehouse. I own a cotton, parts of cotton gins, and I haven't raised cotton in 4 years now, and I have three idle cotton pickers. But at $100 an acre less profitable than soybeans, I just can't plant it. But most people expect about a million acres more, and some of them even thinking a million and a half acres more. And part of that will be East Texas lost a half a million acres, the worst drought in 100 years, and they're going to be back. That's half a million acres to start with. And then West Texas has got the best moisture supply they've had in years, so they're probably going to be up. So it's possible, but I don't think it's going to – it's not going to detract very much from the corn acreage, and the bean acreage in my area is going to be up.
What's expected to happen to the 6.2 million acres that did not get planted to winter wheat?
I drove 450 miles up here, and I saw one 50-acre field of winter wheat. I was stunned. It's going into full-season beans, full-season corn, milo out west, I guess, some cotton. I would think mostly it's going to be full-season non-double crop beans, but it's got to be distributed over all of it, and it means that the bean yield will be slightly higher, because full-season beans yield more than double crop beans.
And your marketing outlooks, how much do you use the supply-demand and those use ratios compared to what you see as other economic indicators, such as the dollar and the Dow, and how those move?
Who's that? Who are you talking
to? I think everybody can take a shot at that.
Okay. The one thing I came in this morning to be, so I was surprised that there's a report tomorrow I don't pay attention to supply and demand because that's not the tools that help me make my decision. When I have something that has been 100% correlated for 40-some years with a long-term direction of corn, I'm going to watch that, and that's the dollar. Long-term swings in the dollar have been 100% correlated with the long-term swings in the corn. Yes, you have things like a drought in 83 and a pick program that gave it a 10-month respite, but the long-term trends are there. And thus, I don't watch supply and demand at all.
I watch it all. That's all I watch, basically. and the dollar. And now we have this long-only index funds. And believe me, all of us as farmers ought to thank the long-only index funds, because in former years, if we had $10 beans in old crop, we would have new crop beans $3 or $4 lower. Now the long-only funds say, well, if beans are $10 in the front and inflation is going on, then they ought to be worth that to more in the next year, and gives us tremendous hedging position. I hedged a lot of corn at over $7 last year for new crop. I couldn't believe it. But we are in a renewable business, and the long-only funds don't understand that, or they don't take cognizance of it.
I tend to use the supply-demand numbers. I also do look at what values are adjusted by dollars in the world. But I also use a graph that's called foreign production deficits. And what that is it's a graph that just visualizes a line that goes horizontal across the across the page, and the bars go down. And what it is, it's taking the U.S. out of the picture, and it's telling us how much need is the rest of the world of our products. And when I look at that, because it assumes that the rest of the world does not produce enough, they have to import. So it kind of gives us a clue of how needy they're going to be. In the corn and coarse grains, there's a much bigger need this year than last year. Unfortunately, there's not much need for wheat. So you've got wheat to sort of infuse in on that. But one thing I thought was interesting, when I combined the two, coarse grains and corn, foreign production deficit charts, I noticed that in 7 out of 10 years, when you had from one year to the next a marked increase in need or demand potential, I found that corn tended to rally into March. What's corn doing? Rallying into March, even though we're in this huge sideways move. It also showed a tendency to rally into April, May. It showed a very marked tendency in 8 out of 10 years to go down in June and July. So basically, you guys are going to be so busy this spring. And I know our Iowa farmers are going to be really busy this spring, because we still have some corn in the field, and we have a boatload of snow. It was interesting flying over. Because I'll tell you what, I drive a Yukon Denali, and I live a half mile from town, and I have snowdrifts higher than my Denali as I go to town. I've been caught in a snowdrift a quarter of a mile from town this winter, and we just have a lot of snow to get rid of, so it's going to be a late spring for us. There's also no field work that got done last fall. Very low fertilizer got applied. So farmers are going to just be really busy this year, at a time when you do need to also think about possibly making some cash sales if the market does what I think it's going to do. So I tend to use foreign production deficit charts. In the beans, we have a less need this year because foreign production deficit takes U.S. out of the picture but does have South America in it. And it shows you that the need is about half of what it was last year. I went back and looked at years where you had marked changes like that. I could have probably taken some minor change years, but I didn't. I just took the marked changes. And I noticed that in the last 20 years, there were 3. And out of those 3, 2 showed that the market went down, put a high in beans in February, went down into April, rallied in May, fell apart into August, lifted into September, down into October. The one year that didn't was the year of 2003-04. And the market rallied that year. Of course, we were also into the demand pull by China that needed everything as they were going towards the Olympics.
The supply and demand of the old crop market kind of sets my overall attitude for current marketings, and I use those S&Ds to set my attitude. Now, I use supply and demand more for my long-term outlook, two-year, three-year outlook, and general trends and carryover, like John was talking about, is definitely the thing that's going to set my grain marketing attitude there. As far as those other influences, when we look at the new stage of the market that we're into right now, and that being an energy market, you lay a corn chart over the crude oil chart, and you can see how well those two markets correlate. Take the price of soybean oil, double it, and lay that over crude oil, and the correlation is amazing. You're within 20, 40 cents almost on a daily basis. So the correlation between the grain markets and the energy markets is more important now than it ever has been. So if there's one of those outside influences that I'm going to look at, obviously Glenn mentioned the dollar. You watch that exceptionally closely, and then the energy markets. You know, you've got to be a good energy analyst to be a grain analyst now.
First of all, don't sell your farm because of what we're saying up here. If you want to sell your farm, I'll buy it from you.
Yeah.
When I look at the markets, I think they've evolved over time, and I've had to learn a lot in the last few years. The first thing that I look at is I think 60% of the price you receive this fall is going to depend upon weather. It always is that way, and it never will change. The other 40% is broken down, number one, by money flow. I mean, I think this week we've seen some money moving out of the grain markets and going into the equity markets on the perception that the economy has bottomed. And your best return on investment over the next 6 months, maybe a year, is the higher stock market. There's about $60 billion of money that was given to the markets this year in commodities to trade, and it was given to more active traders, and the algorithm computer formulas that think and move faster than we do. And so we've seen in the last week, every other day, markets up, down, up, down, up, down, and all this is this money moving in and out looking for the quickest return on investment, and most of it's based on the direction of the dollar. It almost makes impossible day-to-day for the markets to figure out what's going on, and with more and more of the futures market being done electronic trading, day-to-day it's impossible to find value. And so I think we've lost that feature in the marketplace. I think the market is telling you to be 50% hedged in your new crop grain by planting time and then replace that with calls at some kind of April low. And if it's too expensive, like Sue just said, you can use a call spread. But make sure you talk to a broker and you understand your risk rewards in trading that. When you talk to some of the mega farmers in this country, the first thing they want to do is increase production. The second thing they want to do is improve marketing. And so I think these are all important factors that you need to think about. We haven't really talked too much about politics, but you have a current administration right now that's thinking about changing the farm bill and getting rid of direct payments and reducing all the subsidies that were in agriculture because you guys are having such a good year. I think that would be a bad thing for agriculture. And finally, I do look at supply and demands. These funds can push the markets around, but if carryouts are going up, prices are going to go down. And if carryouts are going down, prices are going to go up. And I think, to me, March will be the most important month this year for you as farmers. We're going to know a lot from these USDA reports. And we're also going to know a lot about weather. The end of the month of March, we're going to know if this is going to be a late planting season or an early planting season. And we're also going to know a lot about money flow and where this money is going to go, whether it's going to leave agriculture and go into the equity market. So your marketing plans right now have to be decided now. And these prices, as the panel is talking about, there is no problem about being bearish to $7 beans and $3 corn if nothing weather-wise happens. If you can lock in some costs right now, that's what you should be doing.
Sue and Steve, you've talked some about the
anchovies, and nothing's been mentioned about the dry distiller grain and the fungus that's in the corn and how well it can be blended off and how much that will replace the soybean meal. How is that going to be handled by the market?
Well, I think luckily this year, I think, from a mold standpoint, the biggest concern about mold has been somewhat isolated. But when you take vomitoxin corn and go through a processing, the DDGs that come out are three times more toxic than the corn itself. So no one wants to touch vomitoxin corn, especially if you're putting the DDGs in a container and exporting it to China. I think that the numbers domestically, when you look at the crush numbers, soybean meal domestic usage is declining pretty quickly, and it's in favor of the DDGs. And there are, I think, the poultry industry can go now 100% DDGs, replacing from a protein standpoint. The if we go to E15, if we expand to E15, that's going to be more DDGs available to the marketplace. And so when you look at crush margins right now, they've declined pretty dramatically in the last 2 weeks, led by lower meal prices. And so I think that on the positive side, E15 will add to the demand for corn acres, but on the negative side, increased DDG feeding will reduce soybean meal usage domestically.
Steve, I read something in Ethanol Producer Magazine about the number of blended gallons, and that at 10%, the suggestion was that the average gallon in the United States, or the average blended gallon, was actually only about 6.75% or something like that, ethanol. Why push for a 12 or a 15 if we're already past the mandate at this point by, 100 million or something like that? Why push it up any higher if we're already past it, we're using more than the mandate, and we're not actually blending up to the 10% rate?
Well, I think we're using about a little under 10 billion gallons of ethanol right now and blending for the 150 billion gallons of gas that we use in this country. Obviously, if we get to 15%, that would be more usage for ethanol. The RBD price right now, $2.30, compares to the ethanol of $1.67, and so there's a lot of profitability right now in blending ethanol, and we have the plants nationwide back up to 100% of capacity, and we would probably reach, if all plants were running 13.5 billion gallons of capacity versus the 15 billion gallon mandate, so we really don't need any more capacity. So I think that, on one side, the positive side is that the energy bill mandates that we try to replace imported oil with corn ethanol. That's the law. And so you have to comply with the law, and obviously it's helping agriculture. The seed companies have promised 5 bushels more corn yield every year from here on out. Now, we haven't reached that point yet, but it certainly is in the genes and genotypes. So it's kind of a race between how many acres we need, how much yields increase, and then how much the blend capacity and how much the blend's going to be. Right now, if I'm a car company, I have enough information that suggests that we go to E12 and not hurt cars that are out there over 2001. But there is no research on anything above E12 yet on that process. So there's still a lot of work that has to be done in Washington on the research on the impact E15 would have on automobiles that are older than 2001. So obviously the market is watching this pretty closely. A lot of the index funds bought corn when we changed the energy laws. And if it was to go to E15, I think corn would be another good purchase by these index funds as a long-term investment. So these are all kind of important factors that the market has to decide over the next 6 months.
Yeah, Todd, you mentioned that we're at a 10% blend now, but we're really blending at that, just call it 7%, something like that. If you go to a 13 to 15% blend,
then in reality you're finally getting to that 10% blend. And the way that I look at the blend is it may not increase the total amount of ethanol that you use, because the way that I look at ethanol demand going forward is we will use what is mandated. Not much more, probably not much less. So in 2011, we're going to use 12.6 billion gallons, climbing up to 15 billion gallons of corn-based ethanol in 2015. By going to a 15% blend, 13% blend, whatever it's going to end up being, it just makes it easier to get to those mandated usage levels in a more timely fashion. So we're going to produce to meet that mandate, but I will warn you, Steve mentioned the politics of it. EPA loves ethanol, but they hate corn-based ethanol. All right? So we've got an uphill battle to climb if we're going to continue to get political support for corn-based ethanol going forward. They love the cellulosic stuff. The problem is that we can't do it, and we can't do it efficiently at this point. So that's the reason that for 2010, for example, we were supposed to use 100 million gallons of cellulosic-based ethanol, and we're going to use 6. So they're up to 6% of what was mandated. There's a lot of technology hurdles to cross before cellulosic can pick up where corn-based ethanol is going to leave off.
Hey, a couple of quick things, and I'll switch gears to some respect with a question from somebody from the audience, and I've got several of them here in my hand. You mentioned the 5 bushel per acre push on corn, Steve. He's asked about the 42.5 and whether that was on soybeans, the soybean number, and whether that was really enough and whether the research for soybeans can push bean numbers higher any faster.
Yeah, I think we are. I think we're right on the edge of seeing some of that technology come into play. We're getting some varieties onto the market already that are starting to show a yield boost, and there's some promise from some other varieties that are coming out where these traits are yield focused rather than crop protection focused. So I think we're right on the edge of it. Don't look at what they've done for corn. My God, they've protected the health of that plant deep into the year. They've made it resistant to bugs and disease and everything else. And this and the fact that we've got an exceptionally healthy plant deep into the year is what continues to build, one of the factors that continues to build yield on corn. They're going to do the same thing for soybeans. I don't think there's any question about it. It's just a matter of time before we get there. One other thing, though, when we talk about that yield push on corn, that 5 bushel per year yield push, some of that's going to be up to you guys, because they're asking you to plant a higher population too. And I think we are planting too low a population, because there is room to the upside for economic return at an even higher population than the 32, 34,000 that we're planting out there.
Hey, guys, Illinois and Indiana?
The one?
Statisticians back here. Brad? Oh, he's sleeping.
The one point that I would like to make.
I got a question for him.
The one point that I'd like to make on the bean yields, you know, it seemed like the Roundup 2 variety this year was maybe hurt a little bit by maybe some of the weather or something like that. But I do think that 5 bushel bump is there. But I think it's more important to realize that you're starting to see more and more of these varieties planted outside the United States in Brazil and Argentina, and their production could go up faster than our production. So I think that's an important point that you have to realize, that 10 years from now, what the market is saying is that we've got to plant all the corn, Black Sea's got to plant all the wheat, and South America's got to plant all the beans. And so,
are you sure about the Black Sea planting all the wheat? Why can't they plant the corn or the beans? Why can't China use that from there as opposed to from here? Wouldn't it be easier for them to pick it up from the Ukraine or from Belarus or from Russia than try to bring wheat in from those areas? And doesn't what has happened with corn and its ability to go deeper into the season with less water, probably with drought resistance in the future, make that an area of competition in the world for the Midwest?
Well, topography-wise, the Black Sea grow most of their crop north of here from a weather standpoint.
about Minnesota.
And I think that from a cost standpoint, we're just cheaper to grow than corn. And so I think, their European prices, Black Sea prices, are a dollar lower than U.S. wheat prices right now. So.
Okay. Other John.
I'd like to talk about Russia for 1 second.
Okay.
Before communism, they had 240 million hectares of farmland. After communism, 207, so they dropped 75 million acres. Their yield per acre is half of what the rest everybody else is, and we're getting technology transfer. For instance, I bought a company called Trigon, TRIGONS/A. You can look it on the internet. They are up to like 600,000-700,000 acres in Ukraine and in the Black Earth area of Russia. They're doubling yields the first year. The first year. So I think we're going to have an enormous transfer of technology to Russia, and I fear Russia a whole lot more than I fear Brazil, a whole lot more. I think Russia is the one that is could really hurt us as farmers. And, I mean, I read a lot about it, and they're improving the infrastructure. They've got much better infrastructure than Brazil has. They got a river system, and they've been doing this for hundreds of years where Brazil hasn't. But to give you an example, 5 years ago, India raised the same amount of acreage as they do today and yielded 12 million bales of cotton. Today they're 24 million. They doubled their yield per acre in 5 years simply by adopting BT cotton varieties. And I think we're going to see that kind of transfer to Russia, and it scares me.
No, Todd.
Go ahead.
Todd, to add to that, I agree with John. When you look at China, their corn yields are lagging ours by 30% to 34%. You add in technology, and there's a lot of corn acreage that is going to produce quite nicely, even in China. And China has said that the government said that they were going to start to really focus on the rural areas and try to get people to stay on the farms and to produce. They're going to start gravitating towards more efficiency, not to mention the technology. And so I think there is potential for growth in other areas. I agree with John.
Glenn?
In terms of how the macro degree trends work, all of this, I think, is, well, not all of it, much of it, though, is in response to the mania we saw in the last decade when we peaked in 2008. Because I define mania as mathematically what it takes to be a mania, et cetera. So cause and effect here. Manias and grand manias, which we saw on virtually all commodities except the meats, have an unerring correlation to lead to long-term surpluses. And we do that by maximizing current production and stimulating the growth and capacity for production. And much of the world right now has been inspired to greatly increase, maximize their current production, much less increase the capacity to produce. So I think there was just a lot of competition coming historically.
Okay, another question, and this one will be targeted, Glenn, at you. There are still a lot of market watchers forecasting $2,000 gold by 2012. How will that affect corn and soybean prices, and what can we do to prepare?
To me?
Yep.
The foregone conclusion of $2,000 gold is a faulty conclusion at this point in time. It may happen. I have a probability of 80% probability that we will not see a new high in gold until 2011 if we see a new high in gold. However, if the bull phase in gold is done, which I don't have a probability on that. The market hasn't told me yet. But if it is done, I will see $500 gold before I see $2,000 gold. And if that happens, gold is 90% correlated with grain prices over the long haul. The dollar is 100% correlated. I have a 90% probability that we have started a multi-year bull market in the dollar. I will have, that probability will jump if we get a solid close above 81.50 in the cash dollar index. And that is like $1 point away. Those trends occur. Gold is not going to 2,000 at this time. However, sake of argument, people run to gold. Take it to 2,000, That's speculation of greed and speculation of fear about other problems. If the dollar has a bull market while gold runs up, the dollar historically trumps gold on driving grain prices. So I will bet on the dollar. In other words, I will say that that will have no impact of great magnitude on the grains if the dollar index is also rising. I guess that'd be the bottom line at that point. What I fear right now, for people's sake, I do not like the message I shared on this show with you. I don't like to have to share that. But in the cycle of man and the behavioral pattern of man, we have rotated through asset speculation, starting with commodities in 80, peaking in 80, paper assets that had their first peaks in 2000. We had the energy startup. We had the real estate run. Then we had the commodity run, and everything together had a run into 2007 and 8, and that is your grand finale climax of speculation. And that rotation of man historically now goes to one commodity, cash. The next bull market, no, excuse me, the current bull market is cash. And a cash bull market is, I wrecked a car last fall. Well, I opened deer season early last fall. And to stay with my plan to buy a new car this spring, I bought a used car last winter. It was booked at $4,500. Figure I put a lot of miles on it this winter. Fine, I'll go for it. I went to see the guy. He had it advertised for $2,500. I asked him what business was he in. He was an assistant sales manager at a car dealership. He sold it to me for $2,000. I bought a $4,500 book car for $2,000. That's what a bull market in cash looks like. And he bought it. When the moment I gave him the check, he said, now I know I have at least my next three house payments made and groceries bought. That's what a bull market in cash looks like. Cash is going to be the tight one in years to come.
John, you look like you want to talk.
I see debt is going to eat everybody alive. Japan right now has their average interest rate is under 1%, and it interest is taking 27% of their tax dollars. If their interest rates go to 3.5%, Japan spends every single dollar it gets on debt service. It's all over the world. I think politicians will not cut spending, and they can't raise taxes, so they resort to the printing press. And I greatly fear that we're going to go to some horrible hyperinflation and it'll decimate everybody. No one can keep up with hyperinflation. I mean, your interest rates go up exponentially, your costs go up exponentially, and your salaries go up slower. So I'm very fearful. I don't know what's – I just think it's the worst setup I've ever seen. Yeah. And it's worldwide. What's going on in Greece? Watch Greece, because if Greece doesn't come out, they're going to hop on Portugal, then they're going to hop on Great Britain, and then they're going to hop on Japan, and then they're going to hop on the country that's got the worst financials of all, and that's the U.S.
Yeah. Somebody wrote down the question, how do you protect yourself against hyperinflation?
You just don't own cash. You do like Brazil and Argentina. You get your salary, and you spend it within an hour.
I've got one who wants all the cash he can manage, and yet...
I'll gladly take all you'll offer me.
Yeah.
Cash.
I hope I'm wrong, incidentally. I hope I'm totally wrong, but the debt situation is just massive, and I think it can swallow everybody. Look at the state of Illinois. They got a $12.5 billion deficit, and they're issuing vouchers to vendors. I mean, this is horrible stuff.
I can address that issue right now. John, you may be dead right about hyperinflation. I am concerning that that is the outcome, too. We saw this similar pattern from 1694 in England. They had an inflationary bubble that peaked in the 1720s. They had 40 years of deflation in the 1760s as their debt grew beyond imagination because the people started saving, like Japan, going from a 5% rate to 25% savings rate because people are afraid. They put the money away. Historically, when they've tried to do this with the printing presses, one of the biggest problems they have is getting the money into the hands of the people. And as you put the money out in the hands of the people, they bury it in coffee cans.
when they're scared like this, when the government gets to be increasing activity. I mean, these are studies. These are objective things. So eventually they may have to self-destruct, but you're exactly right. If we have to pay more for debt servicing, that's going to take the rest of the energy out of the economy. That's going to take the cash out. And if they tax you to pay for it, it takes more cash out. It's a bull market in cash right now. Now, if history holds true, the earliest I see hyperinflation in terms of probability is after 2016. I have right now about a 5% chance that we go into hyperinflation sooner than that. It is a possibility, but the dollar will have to falter and fail. And when the market tells me it's weakening and failing, I'll worry about it. At the moment, it tells me we're going to end up testing the dollar for steroids before we're done, the way it looks to me.
Okay, some other questions here. Here's a good one. This one is for you, Steve. He says, explain how China can cancel orders on sales. Do they have to pay penalties to the brokers? And if so, how much? How do they cancel an order?
Well, first of all, I think a lot has changed in the last few years. A lot of consolidation within China in the crushing industry. You have fewer players. You also put up 20% of the vessel up front, and as far as the cost of the vessel. And China's are good players in the futures market. They know the impact that their buying has on futures, or their impact not buying has. I think in dealing with the multinationals, one of the things that surprised the market is that the beans that they have bought from the United States, they will ship from the United States. And so that's tightened up the soybean situation a lot tighter than what people had anticipated. But I personally don't foresee them moving a lot of beans to South America. They have additional purchases that they would like to make. And we'll just see how tight the old crop soybean situation gets if they do export all the vessels that they have bought from the United States.
So we'll close out with a couple of questions for you. Somebody would like you to talk a bit about livestock at a 12-month high. Where do we go from here?
Well, I think, first off, in the cattle market, I think we have a good year going in cattle. When I look at the June contract on an average basis or a normal basis over history, it would depict that the cash market should actually get a little stronger. I tend to think that we're looking at exports of beef that are picking up this year, less numbers. And so I tend to think year over, we're looking at a pretty good cattle market in all. Now, when we look at the cattle on feed report, we're probably putting in a fair amount of heavyweight feeders, 800 pounds and over. And so those cattle, probably if you look at the futures of April to June and they're like almost on par, you could maybe shove those cattle out of April into May or something like that for marketing. But when I look at the export picture, you know, you look at China, they're going to import beef this year. They're going to be a net importer of beef. And a chunk of that beef could come out of the U.S. You have Canada, who's down in numbers. We're down in numbers. And, you know, it brings one other market to mind, is the milk market. I think that dairymen down the road, and this is kind of a long-term picture, but as we see a growth around the world and they start getting a taste for better milk instead of powdered milk, they get better milk, I think milk prices are going to go up. And in the meantime, you have less dairy cows around. And so I guess I look at the cattle industry as a whole in an upswing, and I think the April contract might make it to 96.
Real quick, there's one cycle in agriculture that I really pay attention to. It's a 10-year cycle in cattle. We put in lows in years that end in 6, highs in years that end in 3. The supply and the demand, with our supply coming down and our demand starting to come back up, fits real well with going to a high in 2013. It'll probably be higher than most people think.
I love this one. I get to say that if you want to say that my outlook is bullish or bearish, bullish cattle. I am not bullish. The market tells me. There's a couple of things going on in the cattle for me from a different perspective. One, the meats have yet to have a mania. So they are a candidate for speculative money. Those markets are have much smaller capitalization, so if money moves into those, we can move a long way. Two, economic trends that I see historically are actually beneficial for the meat consumption, with more meals being eaten at home. You make bigger, you know, your patties that you get at McDonald's are a whole lot smaller than what you make at home. Those things. Technically, I've got cattle drawing up into May, and then we'll see what happens. But I also show cattle, if you want to look at it from a purely chart standpoint, we had a 25-year trading range. We broke out. We paused for 6 years on top of that. I wrote a book about that pattern where you pause normally between three and eight years in this instance. And then if you break out the top, it's when you get your vertical bull markets, you get your eruption. So you have the shot at a mania coming in the cattle industry. Chip, interesting, though, I'd point out, if you add 10 to the last low of 1996, that's 2016. You've heard that from me a couple times.
Yep.
I also run a 14.2-year cycle in cattle that last bottomed in 2002. Add that to 2002, that's 2016. So I think what will happen here is we'll get a mania, probably getting more people thinking like they have to walk their grain off the field or off the farm. I think we'll see we'll actually see the price manias occur as we build up the herd again, as we take females out of the licks. And that's how you get your maybe as high as 2013.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a little late for me cyclically. But other than that, yep. And then we will come crashing down.
Dave wants me to be done, but I want you folks to take up one final topic, and I need you to be 30 seconds short. Land values.
Oh.
Take up land values and just your very quick few. We can start down on this end.
I don't know. I don't track land values except for the long-term economic trends, but the trend should be down.
We're very excited in the South because where I farm, 60-70% irrigated land has been going 25 to 3,000 acre, which is very high for us. But this last week, some land in the Boot Hill traded 1,400 acres for 5,100, so we're all happy. But I marvel at the prices, the differential in prices between our irrigated land with five crops working against your dry land with basically beans and corn. It amazes me, the differential. You've got to be much better farmers than we are.
Sue, you got a comment quick?
No, you go.
Okay. The first three quarters of 2009, we were soft. That last quarter of 2009, it started to roll back up, and this is just general across the Midwest. First quarter of 2010 is going to be higher again on land values. I'm with Steve for long term. If you've got a farm you want to sell, give me a call.
I think a lot depends on Washington politics and how fast global yields increase, but there's a lot of money in the world right now that's buying land in Ukraine, Central Africa, Brazil, and so my feeling is that it should be positive to land values.
Give these folks a great big round of applause. Glenn Ring, Chip Flory, Steve Fried, John Bondurant, and Sue Martin. Thank you all so much for coming in. They will be around, so if you want to talk to them, please do that. Dave Dickey is here now. He's got some instructions and a couple of other things before we head to that really good beef house luncheon. Dave?
Wow, what a morning, huh? Give the morning an applause.